That's our signal to begin episode 97. Thank you so much, Paula, for all of that. And thank you to all of you who dialed in this morning. We are eager to share these questions and answers with you. And before we get started, I just want to mention Revenue Warriors. Okay, so let me see if this describes you, because it might. Are you that person who's just really, really sticky and adamant about getting things right? Are you that person who's passionate about the payment being correct? And are you maybe somebody who feels like you're an island, like you don't get support, or you have questions and don't know where to get the answers? Or maybe it just feels like you're doing the same thing from day to day and you know your processes aren't exactly efficient, but you're just so busy doing the day to day, there's no time to figure it out or get some sort of corrective action in place. Or maybe it feels like it doesn't matter if you figure it out, nobody's going to listen anyway. And they don't want you to upset the apple cart. So if any of those things apply to you, that's what Revenue Warriors is about. It's about supporting you to help you do your job better, to help you find answers to those tough questions and identify and correct ineffective processes, determine what corrective actions are necessary, and become an organizational influencer. So Revenue Warriors are a group of multidisciplinary professionals that share ideas, share processes, get and give answers to questions, and basically encourage and build each other up. It's about learning and supporting and sharing. And if that's not enough, you also get secrets, if there is such a thing, to becoming a revenue warrior, that is that organizational influencer for correct revenue, through direct access to our expert consultants who give coaching and mentoring and expert advice to help you initiate the change, correct and incorrect or inefficient processes, and bust up those silos and disconnects. And, of course, there's tools and training and all of that stuff. It's a community, a safe place to ask questions. And you probably, if that any of that rings a bell for you, you want to go over to aq-iq.com and get on the wait list for Revenue Warriors. You'll find it in the blue and white bar across the top where it says Revenue Warriors. And if you don't see it, you can just reply to any email you receive from aq-iq.com, and we'll steer you in the right direction. So it's going to open October 2nd, so we really need to have everything in place. And Paula, did I miss anything?
I don't think so.
Okay, great. Well, you are signed up.
No, I was just making a joke. Pam usually has to cut me off on that first part of the show on the insiders portion. So if you didn't call in before to get the little mini training we do in 10 minutes, I actually made it by 10:10 today, guys. That's so exciting. So
yeah,
Pam, go ahead over and
celebrate that. Okay, so I'm going to throw out this first question to you. Yes, this is from Anonymous. And Anonymous works in an inpatient rehab. So they're describing this rehab patient. The IGC is debility. The etiologic diagnosis is peritoneal abscess. It says, assessment supports the medical necessity of inpatient rehab because the patient requires acute comprehensive rehab, including PTOT, 24-hour nursing care, close medical monitoring by physician for medical comorbidities. The patient has gait disorder, impairments in self-care, activities of daily living, balance, transfers, and safety. The comorbidities are gait disorder, generalized weakness. The pre-admit rehab consultation shows impaired mobility and ADLs due to sepsis from peritoneal abscess. The patient is still taking antibiotics for the abscess. So what would I do for the principal? Would it be the abscess, the gait disorder, the weakness, or the debility?
Now, based on the documentation that was provided, it looks like abscess would be the principal. Now, this is all dependent, of course, upon how the physician is documenting the case, if the patient is still being treated for the abscess, and if the physician documentation was clear that the abscess was the cause of the deficits that led to the need for rehab, you know, which appears to be true based on the small bit of documentation that was provided. Of course, then the abscess would be appropriate to report. Now, remember, the IC-10 guidelines define the principal diagnosis as the condition determined after careful study to be chiefly responsible for occasioning the admission. One way to determine the principal is to ask, what exists? Is there an existing underlying condition? If the answer is yes, you code it. If the underlying condition has been resolved, you ask, was there a surgery? If yes, report the appropriate aftercare code. Finally, if the underlying condition is resolved and there was no surgery, then you would report the residuals of the resolved underlying condition. For example, in this case, if the abscess was resolved, you would report the debility or gait disorder, dependent upon which one that it was better supported by the physician documentation. Now, that's a rule that we use when we're evaluating the principal diagnosis, not the etiologic. But I will say that it doesn't work 100% of the time. So use that as a guide, but don't go, oh, well, it doesn't meet this litmus test, so it may, but it may not in some situations, I'm saying. Most of the time it does, but in some situations, which I can't think of off the top of my head right now, but I'll surely want to see one in an audit, and I'll go, oh, that was what I was trying to tell those guys. So as best as possible, try it and see how it works out for your cases.
Well, thank you. All right, and I have this question is from a hospital, and Freddie has sent it in and is talking about a post-transplant follow-up with acute rejection in the PATH report. Would I code the follow-up or the rejection as primary? This is from a hospital.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you, Freddie. There's a couple questions I have about this question. So I don't feel like I can give a complete answer on it, but we wanted to go ahead and include it. And, Freddie, I'm going to reach out to you, or if you can send us an email back and give us a little more explanation about your question. So is this an outpatient encounter? Is this an inpatient encounter? I'd like to know a little bit more about what was documented. What type of transplant was it? What did the physician document? Because I see that it looks like there was in the PATH report, but it doesn't look like the physician document it. So I'd like to know a little more information. However, I will like to go on record to say if the visit was for a problem associated to the procedure, so like the patient came back due to that complication, I would say, due to the procedure, then, of course, that one would be reported as the principal. And I'm presuming that this is an inpatient because it says principal instead of first listed. A lot of times we refer to first listed when we're talking about outpatient cases and principal when we're talking about inpatient cases. But, Freddie, in other words, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about this question. But as it stands right now, it's a maybe you could code this. So anyway, we'll get together and maybe we can share the response after we talk, either by email or in person, with everyone else on Copy with a Coder for the next session. So, Pam?
Thank you. All righty. So I've got another one, and this one is similar to one I've asked you recently, but it's not the same question. Okay. If we have it's also from Anonymous and appears to be, it's rehab, but I don't know if it's inpatient rehab. Maybe you'll know that already. But the question, if a physical therapist performs three different timed modalities for 8 minutes each, is it appropriate to report one unit for each of them? For example, therapeutic exercises for 8 minutes, therapeutic activity for 8 minutes, and manual therapy for 8 minutes.
This is outpatient because we're talking about those minutes. Now, inpatient does also track minutes, but for billing purposes, this would be an outpatient question. So let's keep in mind that the three types of service listed, the therapeutic exercises, the therapeutic activities, and the manual therapy, there are some bundling edits. So, those three might have just been thrown out there as a for instance. So with the bundling edits, you might need a modifier 59 if that were appropriate. So, but to answer the question, no. If the total time does not equal at least 38 minutes, you can't bill three units. Now, the way I came up with that number is that you have to go into the time period for treatment by 8 minutes to bill for one unit. We established that even in the question. Now, in order to bill three units, the first two would have had to be fully met as 15-unit increments, and then the third go at least 8 minutes into that third increment with, where that each unit, the first two, are at least 15. According to CMS, and I'm going to read you exactly what they say, clearly documented minutes, the total treatment time for the 15-minute time-based codes to support the number of units and codes billed for each treatment day. Also document the total active treatment time, including timed and untimed codes in the patient's medical record. So basically what they're saying is support what's being billed in the number of minutes. And if you only have 3 8-minute increments, that's only, 24 minutes, and that's only going to get you 2 units. So you would pick 2 of the 3, actually, to bill those 2 units. So total time matters, as well as the minutes performing each modality. So it's got to be it's got to balance, in other words. Pam?
Thank you. Yes, and I have one more, and for when you hear the question, you'll know why we're not saying anything about where this person is from. This is an anonymous question, and it could be from anywhere. It could be from your organization. We have a potential compliance issue in our organization due to incorrect coding for a number of years. How do you recommend we determine our exposure?
Oh, good question. Well, first, if you are not a compliance officer, take it to the compliance officer. And if you're scared about that in most organizations, I think that's one of the things that I've seen in every organization, actually, that I've been involved in. There is the ability to report that anonymously if desired, maybe through a hotline or through a comment box. And that's one of those steps that is like a first. So in the past, when I had done work with the DOJ in the Northern District of Georgia, if a case was brought to them, one of the first things they would ask is, did you follow the chain of command? Did you, submit this through the compliance department? If a relator, I would say, came in forward like a whistleblower. And if that person or whistleblower did not follow the organizational chain of command, they would not take the case. They would send it back to, the facility or the organization, wherever, and tell them to go back and follow the proper chain of command, because we have compliance plans for a reason. And that compliance plan should tell you how to handle any potential compliance risk. Now, as far as determining your exposure, you have a couple of options, or you have multiple options, I would say. You could internally figure it out, but I would strongly recommend you go through legal counsel, whether it be internal or external, and different facilities and organizations have different rules about when they're going to hire an external counsel versus using an internal counsel, and likely hire an external consultant or an auditing agency to validate if what you believed was true or not. There are specific rules that CMS has that say when, overpayments are validated. Basically, you have so many days to, and quantified, you have so many days to return that money to the program. So it has to be very carefully handled through legal counsel in the way things are written in a report, in the way things are written in a spreadsheet, in the way the findings are actually presented back, and then how that legal counsel then would go and, discuss with CMS or, whatever entity that there was felt to be a problem. So we do that kind of stuff all the time, but it takes a lot of time to, look at regulations, make sure that, is this really a problem or is this just thought to be a problem? And I'll give you an example. Years ago, a lady I worked with was in a case where she was sitting with the relator, and that is the whistleblower, and her attorney, and she was sitting with the organizational attorneys, and the relator was talking about how things were just awful and things were not compliant. They were being done incorrectly, where this invasive procedure was being done without any physician, there to validate that it was being done correct. And at the end of the day, the person who worked with me was an RN, and it doesn't take an RN to know this, let me say that, but she was very good about it. And she said, so what is this procedure? And it was, they were talking about pulse oximeter, so the lady was trying to get a case, and it really wasn't a case. And she's like, are you talking about that little thing you put on your finger to test your pulse, So it really wasn't an invasive procedure. So that said, that case got shut down, but because you have people come in with all sorts of things. But when there's a legitimate find, you really want to make sure it's handled correctly. So there you go, Pam. I know I was long-winded on all that.
Thank you, thank you. Well, it's helpful because sometimes when we're not really sure what to do, we really need some guidance about what we should be doing. And like you said, that's the purpose of a compliance plan. So, yay. Let's be sure and follow our compliance plans. So, thank you, thank you. I've got one more thing to do, and that is to give a mug. I'm going to mug someone. And if you listened very closely, you could hear only one name. We had lots of anonymous questions come in this time, and one non-anonymous question from Freddie. So, Freddie, you win, and I'll reach out to you and find out where to send your mug. Thank you all for those questions, because from our perspective, we are happy with anonymous and non-anonymous questions. So please do send some more. I would love to have more mug shots. Now, if you're not familiar with that, a mug shot is a selfie of you and us. So if you have a mug, you can put your mug in your mug shot. And if you don't have a mug, you can put our website or a piece of paper with our name on it or something you purchased from here. The purpose of mug shots is to share socially and on our emails to you and on our site where we put up the Coffee with Dakota replays. For now, all the replays are available at aq-iq.com, and we are just excited and eager to be pushing forward towards episode 100, which is coming up very, very soon. Let's see, check my calendar. Episode 98, I believe, is going to be the 14th of September. We will send you email, and thank you so much for being here.